to have a proper ceremony. I had been in the Franklin Village Church many times, rehearsing with the Franklin Village Junior Players. While fine-tuning a talent show in 1973, the contestants took a short break to watch Richard Nixon resign. 10 years later, I was there for something far more important than politics. I was about to close the door on my bachelorhood. The ceremony on March 13, 1983, was as small as possible. We managed to pare participation down to a witness and a ring bearer. Rob and Sam made for the duel best men slash witnesses, and Sam's mother Celia presented the ring, because if she wasn't allowed to attend, she swore she'd never speak to me again. Having endured her loving wrath for years at the Ramey household, I knew she was dead serious. The wedding went off without a hitch, and the Michigan weather gods provided us with a warm, sunny day. By the time Chris and I tied the knot, the soap opera Generations had been canceled. In an ironic twist, years after my marriage collapsed, this tragically poor soap lived on. Watch closely to a scene in the Coen brothers' film Fargo, where a bad guy is glued to the TV in a cabin. There, in poor reception, you can see me arguing with my, quote, girlfriend. Screen time in an Academy Award-winning film? What more could a guy from Detroit want? My next gig came from an ex-employer. Ron Teachworth, a teacher for whom I had taught film classes, decided to pony up his own money and make a film. What resulted was the independent feature Going Back. Up to this time, I had mastered the prolonged scream, the horrific recoil, the slam against a wall, but I never really had to do what would be considered acting. Going Back was fun because there wasn't an ounce of blood anywhere in sight. Just a strange thing called dialogue. Method acting and I are strange bedfellows, but it was refreshing to rehearse scenes just like a play and shoot them simply and efficiently. The entire film was shot in 2 weeks in the middle part of Michigan. The beauty of having next to no budget is that the cast and crew remained small. By the time I was done filming, I knew each person by name and whether they snored or not, since most of us bunked in a single trailer home. Okay, so I starred in a couple films and bluffed my way through a go-nowhere soap opera. So what? I still wasn't a member of the Screen Actors Guild, the holy grail of professional validation. The great wheel of karma rolled back around as I attended an audition for a Chrysler industrial film. The producer was a fellow I knew from my production assistant days. In fact, my 1973 Chevy Bel Air had been towed as an abandoned vehicle while under his employ, and I suppose he felt sorry for me. "What are you doing here?" he asked. "Go get me a cup of coffee." "Get your own damn coffee," I shot back. "I've stepped in front of the camera, pal. I'm a movie star. You gonna hire me or not?" He did, and my first union job was portraying a car salesman with an interesting twist. My character, suit and all, was in a boxing ring next to a Chrysler, the car of choice. When the bell rang, I'd leap out of the corner, weaving, bobbing, and jabbing the opponent, a salesman for Ford in the other ring, with sales-friendly praise for my car. There is nothing harder than memorizing technical jargon. Phrases like, "Let's not overlook the McPherson strut suspension," don't exactly roll off the tongue. Still, that first job filmed for 20 hours and the union overtime alone paid for all of my Screen Actors Guild dues. I was happy to be back in familiar territory, only with a new and improved status. I wasn't fetching coffee anymore. I was having it fetched for me. Chapter 28, The First Hollywood Film. The Terror That Ate Motown. And I'll explain a graphic I had in the book. Inexperience times exponential dollars minus creative control equals disaster. It was time for another flick. I was a card-carrying actor now, damn it all, and the boys and I were going to go Hollywood. Sam had concocted an idea about two crazed killers several years prior to this, calling it Relentless. He recruited his new pals, the Coen brothers, to assist him in fleshing out the script. Sam. Edna, our editor, said, "You got to read the Coen boys' script. They're such good writers." I went, "Oh, God." Bruce, "Yeah, here goes another one." Sam, "You know, Joel's brother Ethan was just a statistical accountant at Macy's at the time. And I thought it's probably going to be awful, but I'll read it because I like Joel." And I read it and I thought, "This is really a great script. These guys know how to write scripts." I needed help because ours was no good, and they came in and helped me with it. The plot became one that Hitchcock used often. A mild-mannered leading man, a security camera installer in this case, gets caught up in a web of fear, murder, and mayhem. Mentor Irvin Shapiro had a hand in devising a new title for the film. He figured that putting the letter X and the word murder in the title would somehow draw the eye of moviegoers. Who were we to doubt this man? The film became the XYZ Murders, and based on the strength of Evil Dead, financing fell into place. At the time, we had no idea how good of an experience Evil Dead was. Sure, we burned off 4 years of our lives and didn't pocket a cent, but we had total creative control. Jumping into the big time meant dealing with the excruciatingly specific and alternately vague demands of a studio. Unlike Michigan dentists, Hollywood executives took an interest in everything. Embassy Pictures, our new boss, was the brainchild of TV guru Norman Lear. His Midas touch, it was assumed, would translate to full-length films. Crime Wave, the new title, compliments of Embassy's marketing department, ended up being more like a master's degree in humility than a film. All along, it was assumed that I would play the lead role of Vic, but a particularly intransigent executive at Embassy Pictures saw things differently and insisted on a screen test. "Why do I have to test for this thing?" I asked myself. I didn't have to test for Evil Dead. So, in Mike Ditz's photo studio, where else, we staged the scene on 16mm and presented it to the execs for consideration. An edict came down from on high. Bruce Campbell will not star in this film. Up to this point, we had never heard the word no in the context of filmmaking. Graciously, Sam offered to beef up a secondary role for me, Ronaldo the Heel. As a co-producer of the film, less screen time allowed me to take a more active role behind the scenes. This was a good thing because we needed all the production help we could get. The Hollywood Actor. Crime Wave provided the first opportunity to deal with this odd breed of human. The studio insisted that, quote, name actors be cast in the lead roles because this would allow the film to be sold around the world. That's odd, I remember thinking. Didn't we just do that with a cast of no-name actors? Oh, well. With a starting budget of $2.5 million, the expectations were a little higher. The film had to sell well, so the main roles were cast out of Los Angeles. As well as being expensive, each, quote, Hollywood actor we hired had, shall we say, unique qualities. Because I was a co-producer and part-time actor, I found myself dealing with the actors, or rather, with the actors' problems. By the time the shoot ended, I could have published a doctoral thesis on insanity. One day, I got a call on the walkie-talkie. Claudia.
Bruce, you better come to the set.
Bruce, what's going on?
Claudia, Louise is freaking out. She won't come out of her trailer.
Why not?
We don't know.
As I approached Louise's trailer, the makeup woman was leaving hastily. She just threw her curlers at me. I knocked on the door and asked if I could come in. Tentatively, Louise agreed. As I entered, I got the shock of my life. Louise had covered her face with clown white makeup and wore bright red lipstick.
"That makeup girl doesn't understand my makeup," she insisted, "so I've decided to do it myself."
There wasn't much point in debating the fine art of makeup because we were behind schedule already. The solution ended up being pretty simple. Louise could put whatever she wanted on her face first thing in the morning, then we'd lure her to the set, away from any mirrors, and completely redo her makeup under the guise of, quote, touch-ups. Brian, a talented character actor, took his role as a criminal a little too seriously and tore his Ramada hotel room to shreds. The explanation was a classic. The ghost of his girlfriend's ex-boyfriend was in the light fixtures, so they had to remove all of them. And they say cocaine is a dangerous drug. Bad Cop, Worst Cop. Crime Wave was a film about good guys and bad guys. As we negotiated for services within the city of Detroit, we ran into a few real-life characters. The Hughes brothers were a classic example. This duo of lawyers owned a place called the Tuller Hotel. In the Roaring Twenties, this was the place to be. Situated in the heart of Detroit, it stood as a reminder of what the Motor City used to be, boasting 1,200 rooms, an elegant lobby, and a ballroom of hand-carved oak. In 1983, it was scheduled to become a retirement home for members of the AFL-CIO. To gain access, we had to get permission from the owners, the Hughes brothers. In a conversation worthy of a Coen brothers film, we attempted to persuade these fellas to let us use their hotel as a location. "How much do you have to pay?" began John, the good cop brother. Rob and I looked at each other. "We've got $10,000, Rob announced. With that, Mike, the bad cop, jumped up blurting, "Hey guys, I got better things to do with my time," and disappeared from the office. Wasn't $10,000 a boatload of money, I asked myself. John, the reasonable one, countered with, "Guys, you'll have to forgive my brother Mike. He's a little testy. Tell you what, you think about what you really want to offer us, and I'll see if I can get him back into the room." Rob and I exchanged glances again. Shit, what do these guys want? I mean, how about if we double it? Mike sulked back into the room, and Rob offered up the generous amount of $20,000 for 2 weeks in this dank, rotting place. With that, Mike sprang from his seat as if electrocuted and vanished without so much as a word. John threw up his hands with, "Hey, sorry, guys. If I knew you were going to come up that cheap, I never would have brought him back in." Rob and I were utterly stupefied. The entire Evil Dead location budget was something like $2,000. Rob bit the bullet and upped the price again, to an outrageous $30,000. Eventually, Mike, quote, against his better judgment, agreed, and the deal was made. But the contract also guaranteed the Hughes brothers prime seats as extras. Look closely to a scene filmed in their elegant ballroom, and you'll see two gentlemen dressed in tuxedos, smiling triumphantly and ordering martinis. Crash and Burn. To this day, the mere mention of Crime Wave to a Detroit teamster elicits a shudder. Oh, now that was a bitch, that one. Rightly so. It was 3 months of swimming against the currents. John Cameron was on board as a second assistant director and had his share of heartache. John, I see Crime Wave as a real turning point in a certain way, because if you survive that experience, nothing in the business could ever be as hard again. Bruce, and how, brother? John, it was the most difficult film ever in my life, and if I were a little older or hadn't been young and naive, I never would have survived. It was terrible. Terrible. The unions and the work rules I knew nothing about, and the production reports I knew nothing about. We had always been so independent, it was like, who are you asking for this crap to send to Susan somebody in L.A.? I mean, tell her to drop dead. We're dying here. I don't have time to do this bullshit. Josh Becker signed on as an extra, but he could smell trouble right from the start. I worked for the first 4 days, but I thought, like hell, I'm going to continue on this mother as an extra, Josh explained. It was so fucking cold out here, so awful. Sam is shooting so slowly. I'm gone, man, gone. Scott Spiegel was the only person who had any fun on the shoot. Scott, you hired me and said, hey, you want to be extras wrangler? And I go, crap, yeah, I can use some dough. Bruce, but you also wound up getting in front of the camera a lot. Yeah, it was great. I was a guy shivering in the cold in one shot, an old man at an elevator, a bum in an alley with you, a dinner guest, all kinds of things. Bruce, you know what's funny about that? You were on camera so much, I got a call from Susan about you. She was the embassy exec. Really? How horrible. What did she say? She goes, I saw that damn Spiegel kid in dailies again. Why does he have to be in every scene? I also got into trouble for shemping too much. I put myself in a news segment as a goofy anchorman, and Susan spotted it right away. Why were you in this scene, Bruce? Well, you see, it's like this, I stammered, groping for an answer. That newscaster was the day job of my character, the heel. It was total bullshit, but she bought it. Every motion picture budget has a buffer of 10%. As overtime mounted, we exceeded that percentage by almost 50%. When this happens, things start to change. Embassy Pictures' first order of business was to dismiss our production manager, Joe. Granted, he wasn't up for the task. His mind was on other projects. I should have gotten the hint when he insisted that a special bat phone be installed in his hotel suite 3 stories above the production office. Regardless of who was managing the crew, the shoot was moving too slowly, and someone had to take the blame. Sam seemed prepared and was actively engaged at every level, so Rob and I figured that he wasn't the problem. It must be the cameraman, Bob. His work was good, but he wasn't exactly a speed demon. As producers, Rob and I felt obliged to, quote, lean on him. We drove him home after rap one night and led the conversation with an innocent question. Rob, Hey, Bob, the pace of shooting seems to be really slow. Anything we can do about that? Bob, well, in case you haven't noticed, Sam is attempting some very tricky stuff. He's an ambitious director. Rob and I were well aware of Sam's embellishments and couldn't disagree. Bruce, well, sure, Bob, we all know that, but why is it taking so long to light the shots? If you're referring to the speed of my work, I can only go as fast as I go. If you want to let me go, that's fine. But I can't and won't be shooting any faster than I already am. Bob's fearlessness put an end to our discussion, and he stayed for the entire shoot. Sam liked the look of wind on film. As a result, much of Crime Wave was staged in the path of an impending storm. In order to achieve the type of gale force needed, several swamp boats had to be acquired from Florida. Just so we're clear here, I'm talking about the type of boat with a big fan behind it, powered by a 350-horse Chevrolet engine. One such scene was filmed downtown at night, directly in front of a retirement home. As the wind machines raged incessantly, a bottle crashed to the street from high above. Inside the shattered glass, a pathetic note read, "The noise is keeping me awake all night long, and I am getting sick. I am dying because of you." My many jobs on Crime Wave, aside from demoted actor, temporary assistant director, and actress cajoler, there should be a union local for this one, also included second unit director. In the case of Crime Wave, it meant that I was responsible for getting shots of cars driving, wheels spinning, the odd foot on a brake pedal, the exciting stuff. One of Sam's shots required a high angle looking past a car to the Detroit River below. The only problem was that at 30 below, the water had iced over completely. Because this wasn't part of the story, it became our responsibility to get rid of it. We started by throwing things off the Belle Isle Bridge, rocks, tires, anything that would penetrate the frigid layer. I managed to find a cinder block, and with great gusto I wiped out several yards of ice. Surveying the aftermath, I spotted a lone mitten floating on the water. "Ha ha! Look at that!" I shouted above the gale. "Some poor bastard lost the glove!" Seconds later, I realized that it belonged to me. I had to find warmth, and fast. Fortunately, the mechanical effects guys always have a truckload of gear, and I begged my way into a new pair of Gore-Tex gloves. Eventually, having run out of debris to hurl, we laid primer cord, a powerful explosive, across the ice and blew the living crap out of it. As they say, anything to get the shot. Hack and slash. Shooting came to a halt some 12 weeks after it had begun, and editing commenced within the confines of our dentist's offices in Ferndale. Unsatisfied with both the pace and the results of our Midwest approach, Embassy Pictures eventually yanked the editing from us and unceremoniously relocated all post-production to Los Angeles. Sam, that was horrible. It was the worst time of my life. I realize now that they were just a bunch of idiots, because if you're making a $3 million movie, you should let the director have a preview, you know? Let him cut his movie. Let him put sound with it and watch it once. Don't look at half a rough cut before you've... Bruce, yeah, they yanked that sucker before it was even cut. Sam, it was really wrong. It was such a horrible, 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 depressing scene. This meant that Rob, Sam, and I had to get our butts to the West Coast if we had any hopes of remaining involved in this film. It all led to a tense meeting in Century City, nerve center of Embassy Films. There we were informed that the company would pay for two of us to stay in L.A., but not all three. Feeling like the third wheel, yet emboldened by months of hard work, I spoke for the group in an unforgiving tone. "Hey guys, there have always been three of us. We're partners. This seems like nickel and dime bullshit." No sooner had the words left my mouth than Jeff, the production accountant responsible for tracking costs on Crime Wave, leapt from his chair and pointed an accusing finger at me. "Look, asshole," he began, "do you have any idea how much you guys went over budget?" I'll spare you the rest of Jeff's tirade. At the receiving end of red-faced invectives, I replied with a resolute, "Look, do whatever you want, pay for whoever you want. The three of us made this film, and we'll all be here in L.A. until it's done." With that, I got up to leave the office, but Jeff stopped me with, "Hey, Bruce, it's just business." I didn't even know how to react to that statement. If this kind of treatment was representative of the film business, then the hell with it. I left the office and went down to the parking garage. Waiting in our rented jalopy for Rob and Sam to return, it seemed like a good cry was long overdue. It felt good to rage against the absurdity of this studio system. Hollywood sucks, grade A, free range, all natural eggs, I told myself, wiping back a tear. What a bunch of insensitive, money-grubbing pricks. Embassy, to their credit, eventually paid for all three of us to oversee the, quote, new version. From an office in Los Angeles, we endured what soon became an almost mandatory function in Hollywood, re-editing and reshooting. In the case of Crime Wave, it meant re-editing the film from almost the ground up with a, quote, Hollywood editor, and filming a set of bookends, a new beginning and ending, that would help explain more clearly what audiences were about to see in the middle. In the end, it didn't make any difference. Cross-genre films like Crime Wave send marketing people scurrying under a desk. A straightforward genre film is no problem. If it's action, you make sure someone is holding a gun in the poster. If it's a drama, you show a big close-up of the lead actor looking pensive. Comedy is a little trickier, but you might employ a conceptual artist to lampoon the film. Combine the genres, however, and you're asking for congestion on Madison Avenue. Crime Wave, in its desire to please all viewers, test-marketed as Broken Hearts and Noses in San Diego. Foreign countries seem to roll with the off-kilter tone of the film more easily. In France and Italy, it was called Death on the Grill and The Two Craziest Killers in the World, respectively. Upon completion, we watched helplessly as the film went down in box office flames. To meet a minimum HBO release requirement, the film opened only in Kansas and Alaska. To coin a phrase, this film wasn't released, it escaped. There was only one good screening of Crime Wave and its miserable existence, and that was at the Seattle Film Festival. The host of the festival took the stage immediately before the show and proclaimed wisely that the film they were about to present was silly. "Put on your silly hat, folks," he told the crowd of Pacific Northwest intellectuals. My mother happened to attend that night, and thanks to the properly warned audience, she maintains to this day that the film was cute. John Cameron has since come up with a term he calls the Crime Wave Meter, a little alarm that goes off in his head when he knows he's about to work on a screwed-up film project. Overall, Crime Wave was a lesson about abject failure. No matter how you slice it, the film was a dog, and everyone involved can pretty much line up to take 40 whacks. As filmmakers, we failed to execute a misguided concept, and our studio refused us the benefit of any doubt. One good thing came from this mess. My daughter Rebecca was conceived during production. While Crime Wave was in post-production, she was born at the Henry Ford Hospital in downtown Detroit. Chapter 29. Back to Basics. The South Will Rise Again. I have seen how a misstep like Crime Wave could and has put filmmakers on studios' don't bother lists. Fortunately, we had a fallback position, doing the sequel to a successful film. Evil Dead 2 was all about licking our wounds. Here's another diagram in the book I'll explain. Experience over adequate times less studio intervention over pi equals creative apex. Rob, Sam, and I had been languishing in a slow-as-molasses financing deal, and because no green light had been granted yet, we couldn't give firm commitments to crew members, even though we had interviewed many. Then an interesting thing happened. One such woman headed south to Wilmington, where Stephen King was filming Maximum Overdrive for Dino De Laurentiis. For some inexplicable reason, she happened to take an audience with him and mentioned that she was interviewing for Evil Dead 2, but we were having trouble getting the money. With that, Stephen King called Dino, Dino called us, and we found ourselves in his gigantic office. 20 minutes later, a deal was in place. Here's how Dino made a deal. He would sit there and not say much, and you'd go blah, 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 and then he would just smack his hands together and go, "Okay." That's how he worked. We were urged to film as close to Dino's studio in Wilmington, North Carolina, as possible, but we were more interested in avoiding studio intervention, so we made a case for shooting in the rural town of Wadesboro. All in all, it made for a hands-free filming scenario, since executives either had to drive 3 hours from Wilmington or fly to Charlotte and drive another hour and a half. Wadesboro was the same town where Steven Spielberg shot The Color Purple. We considered filming on the same piece of property since the owner, Harry, had experience with film crews. The Color Purple was what Harry's face turned when I told him how much we had to spend on locations. I explained that it was unusual for a film company to install 3-phase power, central air conditioning, and 9-inch irrigation pipes to enhance a location, as was the case with the Spielberg film. "He was the Cadillac of motion pictures, Mr. H," I offered, "and we're just the Chevy Nova." Eventually, Harry agreed to the deal as long as we funneled additional services through him. The crumbling local high school was our command center. Sets were built in the gymnasium, dailies were screened in the auditorium, and the library made a fine production office. The school cafeteria didn't have to double for anything because we used it to cook our crew meals. The Pain Train. Filming in Wadesboro was a pleasant experience with the exception of the weather. Ted Raimi would be happy to offer up a few words about temperature, both external and internal. Sam assumed that because his brother was young and eager, he could get him to play the heinous horror hag. To accomplish the desired effect, Ted was fitted with a foam bodysuit complete with monster feet, It took a full 5 hours to get him ready for camera. Bear in mind, the temperature outside was at least 100 degrees with 85% humidity. Inside the gymnasium, with poor ventilation and tungsten lights, it hovered around 110 degrees. The makeup effects crew carried a video camera everywhere they went and documented Ted's waking hours on and off the set. My favorite image was one of the guys pouring the sweat from Ted's monster booties into a series of Dixie cups. At one point in the film, Ted's character had to spin in the air and cause general havoc. To do that, he was fitted for a flying harness. Now, depending on where they're attached to your body, these things will either dig into your groin, pinch your hips, or restrict your breathing. Ted's harness, I suspect, did a little of all three. On top of that, Ted had to wear those damned white contact lenses. Technology had improved greatly since 1979, but these lenses were still oversized and could not be left in indefinitely. Ted's biggest challenge, over and above everything else, was to deliver a high-energy performance. His big scene arrived, and he was spun in the air, take after take. Crew members standing nearby were spattered with flying sweat. In the finished film, look closely as Ted spots my character and bellows fiercely. You'll see a stream of sweat pouring out of a slit in the makeup around his ear. In between takes, Ted was lowered to the floor and propped up on an apple box. When not gulping cups of Gatorade, an oxygen mask was clamped over his face until the next setup. It was worth it, Ted explained later. It got me into the Screen Actors Guild. Evil Dead 2 required my character, Ash, to grow from cowardly wimp to leader of men. This was the first time I ever had to do any kind of long-term weight training. Bulk wasn't so much the issue, it was more about creating a sturdy physique that would work in harmony with the hero in a torn shirt concept. To achieve that, I needed help. Enter Mr. North Carolina. This beefy fella helped me set up a mini gym in an empty classroom and created a program that called for working out 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, for 12 weeks. Sam, in his inimitable style, would wander past my door mid-workout and holler, "You call yourself a movie star? Get that lard ass in gear!" The other half of getting in shape dealt with food intake, or what not to intake. Gone were the morning Egg McMuffins, the banana cream pies at lunch, and the buttered mashed potatoes at dinner. These were replaced with diet slice, fruit, fish, and a protein supplement. The 12 weeks of working out during pre-production went well, but once shooting began, the 2 hours of working out after 12 hours of physical torment on the set became a real test of discipline. As the program began to take hold and my system kicked into a faster metabolism, I began to shapeshift. Parts of me began to shrink, like my stomach and butt, while my chest and arms began to expand. The interesting thing about altering the way I looked was to observe the end result on film. Because it was shot out of sequence, you can actually watch the before, during, and after versions of myself. Sam Raimi strikes again. Sam Raimi is an exponential filmmaker. His knowledge of film and its technique increased with every film. At the end of the grueling 12-week shoot, Hamid, the focus puller, remarked that he had used every technical trick he had ever learned just for this one film. It was always amusing to catch Hamid out of the corner of my eye during a difficult shot because he was sweating more than I was. Sam is a technical animal. As well as knowing lenses, he dives specifically into exposures and shutter speeds, things that directors usually banter about in vague ways like, "I want this film to look kind of moody." Sam would confound the camera department daily with his notions, and subsequently the mechanical effects department, since they had to build the rigs required to get his outrageous shots. One such contraption was the Ramo Cam, a higher-budget version of its Evil Dead counterpart. This consisted of a 20-foot iron pole attached to a rolling cart with the camera mounted at the end of it. This device was designed to puncture the rear window of the Classic, then proceed through the length of the car and burst out the front. 26 takes and 6 windshields later, we got it in the can. The mother of all rigs was the Sam-O Cam. This hellish device was a rotating cast iron X that was attached to the end of a crane arm. I was lashed to this X and spun around in either direction and at variable speeds. Vern, the mechanical effects coordinator, tried to make small talk as he strapped me in.
"Yeah, so Bruce, what'd you have for breakfast?"
"Why do you ask?"
"Well, 'cause I'll be right below you. I want to know what's coming at me."
Sam was at the remote controls, which was probably a big mistake. I was his very own Game Boy for an entire day. All this to get one shot. Another effect called for a blood flood. To get the visual of liquid traveling horizontally at great speeds, trick photography was required. To do this, we built a portion of the set sideways. The camera was also tilted, thereby resulting in a normal-looking perspective. To understand this, tilt your head to the left. Now imagine that the room around you was tilted the same degree. Blood could then be poured from a rig in the ceiling, and it would look horizontal. This meant, however, that to assume a standing position, I would actually have to lie sideways, supported by a board. Above me, a 55-gallon drum of fake blood was mounted with a bathtub-sized plug. The idea was to pull the plug, and I'd get hit full force. Sam, okay now, Bruce. If something goes wrong and you're drowning, wave your arms. Bruce, but that's what I'm supposed to be doing. How will you know the difference? Sam looked at me blankly, then turned to the mechanical effects guy. Sam, hey, buddy, how long will the blood last? Effects guy, long enough to empty 55 gallons? Sam, huh, good point. Okay, let's shoot it. I lived to tell the tale, but every time I blew my nose for the next 2 weeks, the snot was bright red. Sam has never been one to stick to the industry standard of filming at 24 frames per second. 24 frames to Sam is slow motion. Many sequences in the film were photographed at varying speeds to achieve different effects. One scene was filmed much as an animated scene would be done, one frame at a time. This made it interesting for the actors, as we were forced to slow our motion down by 24 times. Then there was the issue of reverse motion. This effect can be used to inexpensively achieve strange and otherwise unattainable movements from actors. Watching dailies one night during a scene in which I was assaulted by my former girlfriend's tongue, a scene deleted from the film, Sam pointed at the screen and shouted, "That's the worst reverse motion acting I've ever seen," something you would only hear on a Sam Raimi film. The remaining weeks were spent spinning, getting doused with perhaps the highest volume of fake blood ever recorded on film, and napping with a fly swatter. Out of sheer bullheadedness, I had insisted on using the original time-tested Karo syrup formula from the original Evil Dead. The visual effect was nice, but I became the object of desire for every fly in Wadesboro. Chapter 30. Go West, Young Man. Email. Bruce, when I move to California, are you going to marry me, or are we just going to be lovers? Amanda. Now that Evil Dead 2 was in the can, it dawned on us that we should get our butts out to L.A. permanently and have a go at it. One of the tools of an actor's trade is the demo reel, a collection of scenes that highlight whatever it is you think you can do best. Fortunately, I had the footage from three films available and put together a serviceable presentation. Armed with this and a new batch of headshots, I reconnected with the manager I met years before, and he took me under his wing. His first duty, aside from masterminding my career, was to help me get an agent. The process starts by meeting with any agency your manager can get you into. Those that find you marketable will invite you back. These callbacks usually take place in the agency boardroom, and the goal is to charm the pants off every agent in the room because in many cases, they won't take you unless they all agree. The questions come fast and furious. How do you feel about TV, Bruce? Never thought about it. Well, you should. It's a great way for a mass audience to become familiar with you, and it makes it easier for us to place you in bigger features. What do you see yourself doing, Bruce? I've been doing independent features, so more of those would be fine. That's the point where all the agents in the room exchange nervous glances, because I had just signaled to them that I might not be the cash cow they were looking for. Sure, independent features are a great place to start, Bruce, an agent offered. But where do you see yourself going eventually? That was a great question, but I didn't have the answer. The idea of chasing the holy grail of fame and fortune never crossed my mind. I had moved my young family to California because it seemed like a logical progression, but to assume that I would immediately skyrocket to fame seemed absurd. I'm a working stiff actor, I told him. I just want to work. Ah, so you will do television? Sure, I guess so. Apparently that was the right answer, because the agency hired me. Flush with cash from the sequel, I promptly bought what was most likely the last house in Southern California priced under $100,000, a great starter home on Delight Street in the outlying community of Canyon Country. Getting accustomed to the insanity of California real estate was the biggest adjustment I had to make in moving west. Back home, I gave up a two-story home on a tree-lined street in a good location that had cost $35,000. Now I had a single-story home on the edge of the desert with a dirt backyard for three times that much. Well, I'm here, I thought to myself. I'll give it a go and see what happens. To my amazement, I got the first acting job I auditioned for, a supporting role in the waning television show Knots Landing. As the makeup man surveyed my face, I sensed that something was very wrong. "I think we should pluck between your eyebrows," he said with the bedside manner of a field nurse. Really, why would you do that?" "Because you'll look far more intelligent." Foolishly, I let him do this, but he had other ideas and rummaged in his bag for a small container of mellow yellow. "This gets rid of all the red blotches," he explained. "Errol Flynn would have had no career without it." With that, he proceeded to cover up every wrinkle, blotch, and inconsistency on my entire face. Didn't really matter to him what type of character I was playing. He was more concerned with fulfilling the TV mantra, make everyone look perfect. That episode, filmed on the old MGM lot, was an eye-opener. The speed and clinical nature of it boggled my mind. Michelle Lee, the leading lady, ran the set like a drill sergeant and laid out all the blocking. "Isn't that the director's job?" I asked myself. After the first take, the director looked to his camera crew. "Okay with you guys?"
"Yep, good for us."
"Cool, print it, let's move on." One take? Are these people out of their minds? I was used to 10, 15, or 20 takes to get a shot right. This wasn't filmmaking, this was posing in front of the camera. When I got home after that first day, my wife Chris chuckled at me. "You look prettier than I do." I didn't have another TV job for 6 years. Revelation number 1A. The Hollywood term dream factory is true, or at least the factory part. Meanwhile, cash was running out. The Knots Landing gig plugged a tiny hole in my financial dike, but I had to find another job fast. My son Andy was born not long after arriving in Los Angeles. Aside from the elation that comes with being a father the second time around, I was struck by the realization that my financial obligations were mounting. Before things got ugly, I got a call from a director, Bill Lustig, whom I had met during our Evil Dead sales days. He had just seen the release of Evil Dead 2 in a theater and was convinced that I was perfect for his next film, Maniac Cop. "You're a cop, see? And you're mistaken for another cop who comes back from the dead to get revenge on all the bad cops who set him up. Sound good?" It was a ludicrous idea, but Mr. Bank Account convinced me to take the job. Next thing I knew, I was weaving through a massive crowd on the streets of New York City during the St. Patrick's Day parade, shooting my first non-boys movie. Despite myself, I felt like an adult. Maniac Cop was the perfect job at that time, but I was so in debt that I wound up flat broke by the time the shoot ended. At the cast party, I said my goodbyes and slipped out at 11:30 that evening. This was early for a Hollywood party, but my security guard uniform was in the car, and I had to report for work at midnight. On Guard. Back in Michigan, I filled income gaps with the occasional odd job. Broke once again, I considered the options and decided that being a security guard at night would fit the bill just fine. If I had an audition during the day, I could always drag my butt out of bed and make it happen. Aside from that, I got to wear a costume. In the office of Desert Patrol Security Services, an employment officer reviewed my application with confusion.
"Says here, Mr. Campbell, that you made $125,000 last year. Is that true?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, then what are you doing here?"
That was last year." I'm sure he figured me for a closet alcoholic, but I got my assignment. The midnight to 8 a.m. shift, gate 2 at the Anheuser-Busch plant in the San Fernando Valley, effective immediately. So there I was, guarding beer. Frankly, I was hoping to snag a boring assignment at some obscure part of the facility, but that's not my lot in life. Gate 2 was the trucking gate, and all vehicles coming in or going out of the plant had to pass by us. Each night for 8 hours, we had to tag and weigh a never-ending stream of trucks hauling beechwood. Beechwood aged, just like the ad says, grain and beer. My gate partner and I got along pretty well until he recognized me.
"Holy shit! You're that guy in them Evil Death films. Hey, say that groovy line."
Eventually, the D-Tech's assignment spared me from the hell of Gate 2. This entailed walking the entire complex, an 11-mile route, key punching a handheld clock at specific locations and at specific times. This was all fine by me. I'd rather walk for 4 hours in solitude than listen to the ramblings of Carney Boy or our dope-smoking CO, Sergeant Know-Nothing. Some mornings, after the shift, the bleary-eyed guards were gathered to attend terrorist prevention classes. God forbid that beer should fall into enemy hands. Being a security guard was great for character studies, but it was time to move on. Fortunately, the studio behind Evil Dead 2 was in search of a television version of the film, and we managed to weasel ourselves onto the payroll. I hung up my guard uniform the day I got the news. Editing Evil Dead 2 for television was an absurd endeavor. The film, in its uncut state, races on through carnage and mayhem without so much as a second glance from my character, and it all seems like a twisted Warner Brothers cartoon. Cutting the violence down and lingering on my horrified expression actually made the violence seem far more real and disturbing. Whatever the case, the film has never seen the light of network TV and most likely never will. Chapter 31. Cashing in on the cult. Email. Hello, Bruce. You rule. I'm sure you know. Evil Dead series kicks ass, and you make any other film 10 times better. Which is sad, because you're in a lot of bad films. Why is that? Bye-bye now, Kevin S. Everyone's got to start somewhere. Jack Nicholson, one of the most respected contemporary actors, got his start in B-movies, The Terror, in 1958. Steve McQueen, a personal favorite, hit the big screen in The Blob. And lest we forget, James Cameron, the man who brought you Titanic and Avatar, two of the most successful films of all time, also made Piranha 2. I was happy to be in such good company as I began a run of B-films following Evil Dead 2. Scott Spiegel, now also living in L.A., got his director's wings and shot a horror flick called Intruder, based on a Super 8 film we shot years before. I played a small role as a cop who surveys the aftermath of a night of carnage, and the actor who played my partner was Lawrence Bender, who went on to produce Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, further supporting my theory that all roads lead to B-movies. Another project, this one in Michigan, was a science fiction film called Moontrap, and I was commissioned to play the second fiddle to Star Trek's Walter Koenig. John Cameron was co-producing the film, so it was a great homecoming. This job brought to mind an old adage I'd heard as a Detroit actor: if you want to work in Detroit, you have to leave. The idea behind it was simple. If you lived in Michigan, you weren't considered a serious actor. I guess now that I lived in L.A. for all of 6 months, I was legit. The challenge of Moontrap was to present a convincing tale which took place largely on the moon, all within the confines of a Michigan warehouse. After much testing, ready-mix concrete powder was chosen as the best substitute for moon dust. My favorite image of this film was a handcrafted sign posted at the edge of the set proclaiming, "No liquids." Later that year, an offer came through, in the nick of bank balance time, to join the cast of a horror comedy called Sundown, A Vampire in Retreat. Destination, Utah. As a kid, I used to pore over maps of the western states. The lack of humanity in Wyoming and Utah astounded me. Is the Wild West still alive, I'd ask myself? As I looked around the isolated town of Moab, Utah, the answer was, hell yes it is. Moab has since become the mountain bike capital of the world, but in 1988, there wasn't an ATM machine in sight. Having come to the attention of director Tony Hickox in the Evil Dead films, I was hired to play a descendant of Van Helsing, the legendary vampire hunter. Actors love to spin tales of long hours and backbreaking work on film sets, and I could bore you with that too, but this shoot was different. I was paid to explore the howling wilderness of Utah. Plagued with a character who appeared intermittently throughout the film, the production company didn't know what to do with me. There weren't enough days between shooting my scenes to let me go home, and it didn't make economic sense to shift scenes around to accommodate me, so they just kept me in Moab. On average, I worked 2 days a week for 6 blissful weeks. B-movies are a great crossroads where actors on their way up meet and work with actors on their way down. Sundown was a textbook case. David Carradine played the lead vampire and starred in his own TV show Kung Fu back in the 70s, but since then, he's been in his share of exploitation films. I shared a van ride with David to the set one night. The driver was all excited because he was a big fan. Driver: Mr. Carradine, I just got to tell you, I still have my Kung Fu lunchbox. David: Yes, so do I. The second season, I used it to bring my lunch in it. John Ireland, who played a puritanical vampire, had been in a number of A pictures, including the best picture of 1949, All the King's Men. I'll always regret not capitalizing on a chance meeting with him at a local restaurant. John was sitting at a table right next to me, but but I was too shy to go over and introduce myself. Get John Travolta on the phone. Ironically, this immersion into cheesy genre flicks rekindled my interest in independent filmmaking. If these morons can get money for films, I thought, so can we. The following 3 months led partner David Goodman and I on a trip down Nightmare Lane trying to finance Man with the Screaming Brain, a sci-fi horror flick that's basically Body Heat with a brain transplant. During the Evil Dead experience, we met honest businessmen who were willing to gamble on hard work and ingenuity, and it gave us a fair shot at success. This time around, our project became a magnet for every schmuck, loser, and blowhard in the Midwest. Along the way, we pitched the project to anyone who would hear us, and maybe that was the problem. Our search led us down some strange roads, and I'm not just talking metaphorically. A pitch meeting with the scrap metal king of Detroit almost resulted in our untimely death. Pulling into an industrial compound worthy of Blade Runner, we were met by a Doberman and an unstable security guard. "Who are you and what do you want?" he demanded, as if we had ridden to the outskirts of his western town looking for trouble. With that, I reached into my briefcase to get a business card, and I suddenly heard Goodman gasp. "Bruce, you said, Bruce, put the briefcase down. Dave, right, calm down, put it down. Bruce, but see, I didn't know what you were talking about. I thought, what is Goodman's problem? I was just getting a card." "Dave, yeah, that's because you couldn't see his gun. I was staring down the barrel." Unbeknownst to me, on Goodman's side of the car, the security guard pulled his piece and had it trained on us. His twisted mind must have assumed that I was reaching for my six-shooter. Our most absurd attempt to raise money was in the presence of a self-proclaimed venture capitalist. Goodman, upon laying his eyes on this 350-pound character, named him Jabba the Hutt. The guy, for some reason, had a fixation with John Travolta. "Jabba, do you think you could use John Travolta in it?" "Bruce, why do you ask?"
"Well, 'cause I know him. I can get John Travolta."
Goodman and I shared a look. If this putz was so damn smart, why was he working above a pizza parlor in an office that looked like it was decorated by an agoraphobic? "Bruce, hey, Dave, you know what? I think John Travolta could nail Man with the Screaming Brain."
"Dave, yeah, I think you're right. In fact, he's perfect."
"Bruce, to Jabba, get John Travolta on the phone."
"Jabba, what?"
"Bruce, get him on the phone. He's a friend of yours, right?"
"Jabba, well, I would need some advance notice."
"Dave, come on, let's close this deal."
"Jabba, it's a time zone thing, really. I don't think..."
"Bruce, hey, look, I'll tell you what. When you can deliver John Travolta, you give us a call."
Our frustration came to a head with a meeting that Goodman set up.
The prospective investor was a widow, flush with cash.
Dave insisted on running this pitch, and it was fine by me. I was happy to take a breather. During his spirited banter, I could see that the investor, Karen, was losing interest. Her eyes began to wander. I followed her gaze down toward Goodman's feet. What we both saw at the same time was Goodman's calf-high basketball socks under his shorter black dress socks. In the middle of Goodman's impassioned spiel, Karen pointed at his ankles.
"You have white socks on."
The blood drained from Goodman's face and his pitch ground to a halt. On our way back down to the lobby, via the world's slowest elevator, Goodman had a strangely determined look on his face. "What's the matter, Dave?" I asked. You did fine. It wasn't you. She was never going to invest in the first place."
"That's what pisses me off," he said through clenched teeth. "That bitch."
And with that, he hunched over like a sumo wrestler and squeezed out the most prolonged fart I had ever witnessed. Raising money for Man with a Screaming Brain was a little bit like being trapped in a slow-moving elevator after someone farted. The ride took too long and the atmosphere was foul. When I finally straggled back to Los Angeles, 3 months of iffy income had taken their toll. I had no prospects for work and a mortgage that had to be paid. Wait a minute, I thought. Mortgage. That's the key word. Maybe it was time to pass our mortgage to someone else. In the late 80s, Los Angeles real estate was out of control. My wife and I sold our first generic house in 10 days and pocketed $15,000 in the process. Our current house was closer to town and had more to offer. If we sold it, we could live off the profits. That's exactly what Chris and I did. And 5 days later, we walked away with about $45,000 in profit. Listen to me, I'm sounding like that infomercial joker. I made $1 million from my one-bedroom apartment.
Chapter 32, The Dark Side of Ambition.
Email. I just wanted to tell you how much I love your work, and without me, you wouldn't have that nice house of yours, would you? Hope you enjoy it. I'm certainly not. Your biggest, most pathetic fan, Sarah. Chris decided to go back to school, so we relocated to the inland city of Chino, known for two things, cows and convicts. With a new mortgage on my back, the only vague opportunity for work seemed to demand a return to Michigan, again. This time it was to assume the role of producer. Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert managed to get their hands on some cash for a film Josh Becker wanted to do called Lunatics, A Love Story. Josh. I remember sitting there on the back porch of my Hollywood apartment. I had no money, and I hadn't paid any rent, and I had no food, and I thought, well, this is pretty much the lowest point of my life. I have to think of an idea. This is the moment. I'm not getting up off this friggin' stoop here until I've got an idea that someone will buy because I don't have anything else. So I just started to think about titles, psycho, and other words for craziness and crazies and lunatics. Bruce, was there some reason you were thinking about that type of film? Well, I wasn't even thinking of any type of movie. Bruce, I see. I mean, maybe I was thinking about horror movies, I don't know. And I hit on the word lunatics, and I thought, well, what if it's not a horror film? What if it's a love story? So I went over to Renaissance Pictures and pitched it to Rob and Sam. The boys got behind the idea and convinced several Evil Dead investors to put up some cash, some being roughly half the budget. In order to start filming, a lot more had to be raised. I recruited David Goodman to help. We were both still stinging from the brain failure, and we were determined to prove that raising money for an independent feature could be done. As we began the process of pounding the pavement again, I became grateful for all those hours as a kid glued to the TV watching The Little Rascals. Those kids put on a show of some sort nearly every episode, and their fearlessness amazed me. Darla, we need a stage curtain. Spanky, no problem, my sister can sew. Alfalfa, what about refreshments? Froggy, I'll make lemonade. I decided to adopt this hopelessly romantic attitude. If we couldn't find cash, we'll just do without. I fished out a Yellow Pages directory and began to make a series of palm-sweating cold calls. All I can say is God bless America. The fact that merchants of every ilk actually bothered to hear our rambling sales pitch impressed me. Here we were in a large metropolitan area during the cynical 80s, and folks were still willing to listen to a dreamer's tale. Revelation number 28E. The secret to raising money is that there is no secret. Hello, sir. My name is Bruce Campbell, and I'm producing a film in this area. I was wondering if you'd be interested in a business opportunity. Bruce, look, I'm a busy guy. What do you mean, specifically? We're wondering if you'd like to invest in the project. But why in the devil did you call me, of all companies? Well, sir, you have what we need, I said, my confidence building. Gasoline. Gas? For what? Well, for our cars and trucks, sir. We need to move our film crew around for about a month. All right. Come on in and we'll talk about it. What followed was equally amazing. A deal for office supplies, catering, printing, film processing, lighting equipment, construction equipment, lumber, hardware, and paint. To the credit of these fellow entrepreneurs, all of these deals were made with a simple agreement of not more than a page and a half. Goodman was busy hustling in his own right. He knew a wealthy crowd and he knew where to find them. Dave.
Yeah, I was pals with a lot of the parents who sent their kids to Camp Tamaqua, so I showed up on the day when all the kids got sent off. I was taking their luggage out of the trunks of Cadillacs and Jaguars. I was schmoozing and throwing business cards into the trunks. I got two or three calls and eventually got one investment. You do what you gotta do to get your movies made.
It was always a treat to watch Goodman race into my office and perform an impromptu victory dance. Whenever he did this, I knew he had snagged another investor. Still, by the time shooting began, we were extremely cash poor. The in-kind deals left us very little hard currency in the bank. Ironically, it made negotiating very easy. When I told a crew member or agent or supplier that I didn't have that kind of money, I wasn't blowing smoke up their butt, I really didn't have it. The same principle even applied to director Josh Becker. Josh, I just remember the first night of shooting where I had spent 45 minutes setting up a shot and was just about to shoot it, and you walked out and went, "That's a wrap." I was like, "Oh, but we just..." And you go, no, 12 hours is 12 hours. That's a wrap. I go, "Okay, I see how this works. You laid down the law." I did feel kind of cruel. Josh, well, look, you'd given your word to the crew. Once I realized this was the way it worked, that was the way it worked. But I was like, "You can't really mean this." Fortunately, our ragged plan worked well enough to complete the film over the next year and a half, and investors got their money back, plus a tiny morsel of profit. Till Divorce Do Us Part. Email. I went to a WWF wrestling event and thought it was great that I saw a sign saying, Bruce Campbell is God. Take care, Keith. The euphoric feeling that comes with true independence also has a price. All those months of making magic in Michigan were having another effect on the California home front. A cold wind of alienation was blowing. Fueled by other follies over the years, lunatics wound up being the straw that broke my wife's back. My daughter Rebecca flew out to Michigan so she could drive back across the country with me. We had a great time taking pictures and writing a book about the experiences, but when we got home, Halloween Day, something was different about the place. Margarita, a woman who helped around the house, was there, but Chris wasn't. I took Rebecca and my young son Andy trick-or-treating. His dinosaur costume was a big hit with the neighbors. When we got home, Chris was still nowhere to be seen. I put the kids to bed and killed time by unpacking and watching television for a couple hours, but with each passing minute, my sense of dread intensified. It wasn't woman's intuition, but I knew something was up. Chris was never one to stay out late. About 11 o'clock that night, she came home, but there were no hugs and kisses. Instead, Chris stayed on the other side of the dark kitchen. Hey, how you doing? Great to see you. I've been thinking a lot about things, and I'm not sure we want you back. Excuse me? Chris wasn't mean, but there was a resolve in her that I had only seen one other time, when she was giving birth to Rebecca, and I knew she wasn't bluffing. Is this open for discussion? Silently, she shook her head, no. How soon can you find a place to stay? Initially, this seemed out of the blue, but a year or so later, I flashed upon an incident that should have sent up warning flares. I was walking with Chris during a 4th of July vacation. She was weary of my excessive traveling and the inconsistency of our lives. I had no solution and could only offer, I don't know what to tell you, kiddo. This is my life. I'm not sure if it's ever going to change. You may have to trade me in for a better model. I said it with a smile on my face, but Chris wasn't laughing. There wasn't anything else I could say to change Chris's mind, but in the course of the next week, I certainly tried. With all sincerity, I offered to get out of the business entirely if it would keep things together, but it was too late. Chris had truly lost interest. In our 6 years of marriage, I was away from home for two of them, and she saw no end in sight. I'm happy to say that we managed to avoid damaging arguments in front of the kids and those nasty custody battles. We settled our divorce through the same lawyer. Chris wasn't after revenge, just a change of life. There was one moment in the lawyer's office when I gave it a last stab. The lawyer had excused himself to get some documents, and I looked over at Chris across the table. You know, all of this is just a stack of paper right now. Nothing is signed. We don't have to go through with this. I understand how you feel, Chris explained, but I think it's the right thing. The car gag. An interesting event transpired during the course of filming Lunatics that lightened the heavy load of a broken home life. In preparation for the road trip from Los Angeles to Detroit, David Goodman bought himself a 1981 Renault. He was proud of the $500 he spent on this car, really proud. Smug, actually. For days before the trip, he'd carry on about this great new car. Finally, the day arrived to depart for the homeland. John Cameron, whom I enlisted slash begged to line produce the film, rode in my car while Goodman, loaded down with his entire world, traveled solo. Communication between cars was by way of a Radio Shack CB. That way we could keep each other informed about the need for food, gas, bad jokes, etc. The trip was a smooth one until we got to the wilder portions of the West, specifically Green River, Wyoming, off the I-80 freeway. As John and I rose over the crest of a hill, we passed Dave's car on the side of the road. Inside, Dave was barking into his CB radio that no longer had power to transmit. Fucking car! Just died on me! John and I exchanged a knowing look. Gee, Dave, what a shock. My cell phone wasn't getting any reception way out there, so John and I skipped into Green River to get AAA in action. Within a short time, the driver, Dale, pulled up in his tow rig. He was missing several teeth and had hair in all the wrong places. As he hooked up Dave's car, he regaled us with tales of shooting grizzly bears that wandered beyond the boundaries of Yellowstone Park, further to the north. He punctuated his story with the occasional spit through a gap in his remaining teeth. At a Green River garage, the prognosis for Dave's car was iffy. "Might be the battery," the mechanic said. Fine, Dave said confidently. Pop in a new one. $80 later, the car still would not start. It wouldn't turn over. It wouldn't make a sound.
This is going to take some time to sort this shit out, the mechanic figured. You boys ain't in a hurry, are you?
Fortunately for us, the Flaming Gorge National Recreation Area was just around the corner. History buffs will be excited to know that John Wesley Powell launched his famous Colorado River exploration from this area. We launched ourselves into this man-made reservoir created in the 60s and cooled off. It was a beautiful place and left a lasting impression, which was important to note, as you will soon see. Back in town, the news came back, and it was not good. The car's electrical system was completely on the fritz.
Maybe I could get parts in a couple of days, but there ain't no guarantee of success, know what I mean?
These are the times that try men's souls, as the saying goes, and Goodman stood trial for about 4 seconds.
No, you know what? Fuck it. Take the car, he said with a rare finality.
Really? The mechanic wondered. You sure?
Yep.
In a historical context, I shouldn't have been surprised by Goodman's irrational behavior. This is a man with bad car karma. His loyal Datsun pickup truck had been taken by the New York City Police Department because Dave simply refused to pay any parking tickets.
Dave, yeah, walking down the street where I lived in Manhattan, and I saw the cops in front of it and a tow truck, and they go, who's got this Michigan license? I just turned around and walked the other way, and then the car was gone, and I figured, well, I had it for 5 years, and...
Bruce, and so you never tried to get your car back?
Dave, no, because the car wasn't worth what the tickets were going to be to pay.
Bruce, which was how much?
Like, $8,000. But why didn't you just pay your tickets? Because I was busy. I was fucking busy. I went, well, the car's not worth it. Just let him take it.
Lest we forget, he's also the guy who delivered the death blow to my Opel Isuzu. Dave and the mechanic negotiated a $150 sale. The only glitch that Dave didn't have the title of his car. The mechanic wasn't worried and forked over the money. There was no room for Dave in our car, and we could only take some of his stuff. Fortunately for him, Green River was a Greyhound stop, and we bought him a one-way ticket to Detroit. On the last leg to the Midwest, John and I chuckled about Goodman's dilemma. We enjoyed knowing that he was about to endure the longest ride of his life. Buses stop in every backwater town, and the trip was bound to add at least a day to his travel schedule. Still, we plotted how we could rub his nose in it all. Automotive smugness must be punished at all costs. En route, we talked about Dale, the oily mechanic, and how memorable Flaming Gorge was. Eventually, a gag evolved. What if we concocted a false scenario whereby the mechanic and Dale stripped his car, set it on fire, and dumped it into the gorge? It sounded great, but how would we pull it off? We'd have to create an airtight chain of events and some convincing paperwork. Unpacking one of Goodman's boxes in Detroit several days later, we found the first piece of the puzzle, the title to his car. This was an omen that the gag had to proceed. During the production of Lunatics, I had several dealings with the Pontiac Police Department. Casually, I asked a representative if they had paperwork for things like theft, etc. Naturally, they did. It was called an incident report, and they gave one to me. After laborious days of filming, John and I, who were office mates, wound down by working on the gag. A little bit of whiteout removed the Pontiac Police logo, and an old typewriter provided just the right font. To get that official look, we stamped a receive date on it and copied the whole affair several times over in order to blend the rough edges. One thing we lacked was an imposing stationery on which to write a nasty letter outlining the irreversible damage Goodman had done. This came by way of John's girlfriend, Maureen, who worked at a law firm in Detroit. She got her hands on stationery from the Office of the Inspector General, U.S. Treasury Department. It wasn't ideal, but it was close enough for Goodman. By the time the shoot ended, our package was ready to go. I had a long drive back to California, and I routed my trip through Cheyenne, Wyoming, so that even the postmark would look authentic. The letter was addressed to David, care of my brother Don's address in Michigan, which Goodman still claimed as his official address. One quick call to Don put him on alert for the letter, and everything was in motion. Upon returning to Los Angeles, I was promptly kicked out of the house. All seriousness aside, this provided me with the perfect vantage point to watch the car gag unfold, from Goodman's couch. A few days later, Goodman got the letter in question, but he tossed the heap of mail on his desk and ignored them for another day. I casually suggested that he get organized, and that meant answering his mail. Early the next morning, while cradling a cup of coffee and sucking on a Marlboro Light, Goodman opened the fateful envelope. He's one of these guys who moves his lips when he reads, so it was easy to tell where he was in the text. His expression darkened with each paragraph.
Flaming Gorge, what the fuck?
He mumbled incredulously.
Those bastards. Those goddamn redneck bastards.
What's the matter? I asked, playing dumb. This set Goodman off into a tirade about those rat bastard Hicks and how they screwed him over with the car and how he was wanted in the state of Wyoming and that a warrant was issued for his arrest.
Wow, I said nonplussed. Sounds like a mess.
Knowing that Goodman relied on a close circle of friends, John and I alerted them all that this gag was in the works and not to offer any advice other than the fact that he was screwed. Sure enough, each person he called was someone we had already contacted. The color in Dave's face drained as he heard, call after call, that he was screwed. A wedding was scheduled that weekend in San Diego. Dave's good lawyer friend Vic was going to be there.
I know. I'll take the letter there, Dave said confidently. Vic will know what to do.
Vic did know what to do, all right. We had already called him and urged him to repeat the same response to Dave. You're screwed. Dave returned from San Diego a broken man. He began to rub his fingers together, something he only did when he was tormented. I related this information to John, and we were left with only one option, turn up the heat. Mike Ditz's photography partner in Detroit, Paul Price, had a menacing voice. We enlisted Paul to leave a series of messages for Dave regarding the best time for U.S. Marshals to come and arrest him. The timing of each call was easily coordinated since, as his new roommate, I knew when Dave was home or away. The secret of a successful gag is to match the right gag for the right person. With Goodman, panic was the key element. If you got him to panic, all reason would be thrown to the wind. This particular joke would not have worked with any of the other boys since logic would have prevailed. With one or two calls to law enforcement agencies in Wyoming, the whole thing could have been excused as a hoax. Dave endured another anguished day or two, circling his apartment, smoking and rubbing his fingers together. As much as it bothered Dave, I was getting tired of